everybody, and welcome to the 17th annual lecture in honor of Dr. Gaston Segur. The Segur Center for Asian Studies was founded in 1991. It was named for Dr. Segur in recognition of his distinguished service both to the United States, the country, and to GW. And I'm very pleased tonight that we have Dr. Segur's wife, Estelle, with us again for this evening's event. Dr. Segur came to GW in 1972 as a director of our then Sino-Soviet Institute. Before that, he served in the Army in Japan, received a PhD at the University of Michigan, and worked for a number of positions in the Asia Foundation. In 1982, he was appointed to the National Security Council as Senior Director of Asian Affairs. Then he returned to GW in 1984, and then went back in the government service again in 1986 as Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs. Then returned to GW again in 1989, but he continued to serve as a part-time advisor for President George H.W. Bush in 1993. Unfortunately, I arrived at GW shortly before Dr. Segur's passing, and so I never had a chance to meet him. But I think he would be very pleased in the way in which the Segur Center has grown and developed over these years, become one of the preeminent centers for Asian studies here in the Washington area. We're also very pleased, though, to have our speaker tonight, Professor Thomas Rowski, Distinguished Professor of Economics of History at the University of Pittsburgh. Professor Rowski received his PhD from Harvard University, then he spent 14 years at Toronto University before moving to Pittsburgh in 1985. He's a long and distinguished career. He's the author, co-author, editor of some 10 books and over 100 articles or book chapters. So for people in the field, in the China field, he hardly needs any introduction. As a historian, I'm more familiar with his work as an economic historian, but he also has expertise in understanding China's contemporary economic development. And what we're very pleased is that tonight he's going to bring these features together with his talk to share with us his insights in both the history and the current economic development of China. So without further ado, Professor Rowski.
Thank you very much for this kind introduction. I'm honored to be a participant in this lecture series. I like to talk about the Chinese economy, and I fear I have a well-deserved reputation for talking for a long time. I teach a course on the Chinese economy, 2.5-hour lectures, so I better get down to business here to avoid disaster. So we're all familiar with the magnitude of China's recent, ongoing, and protracted economic boom. This is a major event, not just in our lifetimes, but in global economic history. And from that perspective, it's natural that we start thinking, where did this come from? What are the historical antecedents of China's boom? We know that in the study of Japan, in the study of Taiwan, in the study of Korea, not to mention the United States and other countries, that current economic success has stimulated historical study, and the same thing is happening in China, and it's not surprising, especially since we know in the Chinese case that there are substantial historical legacies at work, as my own mentor Dwight Perkins mentions here, as the Nobel laureate Douglas North discusses more generally. And here's another example. Thank you for lowering the shades. I was warned not to get seduced by the view here. This is why the room is set up. So I have to stand and look this way, but now with the shades down, I can look this way as well. We think of education, economists think of education in terms of human capital, we think of investment in human capital, and naturally we think about financial returns on investment. In China, starting in the late 1950s, and for 30 years, there was no financial payoff to investment. And yet people continued to study. They continued to push their children to seek advantage from opportunities in higher education, which is another example of the historic forces at work in China's ongoing boom. So we look to the historical literature, and we find two immediate problems. One is that while the economists are obsessed with studying China's economic success, Our historian colleagues are still thinking about China's economic failure. When I first studied Chinese history in the early 1960s, we learned about China's failure to industrialize, and the historians are still at work. Ken Pomerantz, in his excellent book published in 2000, explains why China failed and Britain succeeded. And a second problem is that now, while economists are very much enthusiastic about studying the impact of institutions on economic change, the historians are turning away from this. So Pomerantz specifically dismisses institutions as an explanation for China's relative backwardness in looking at the 18th and 19th century. So essentially, we need some sort of bridge that will enable us to think about what didn't happen 150 years ago, and then what did happen 30 and 40 years ago in a single comprehensive intellectual framework. That's what I'm trying to pursue here this evening. So we have to have some kind of dynamic analysis that will allow us to comprehend both failure or stagnation and growth from a single perspective. So what kind of historical legacies am I talking about? I'm getting ahead of myself here, but if we look at the early accomplishments of the Chinese reform era, so I'm essentially thinking about the 1980s, I think that the standard analysis of this decade by my fellow economists is missing something, because what's happening, especially in rural areas, is poverty alleviation. This is the greatest episode of poverty alleviation in human history. And yet, if we look at it from a World Bank perspective, there's something very odd here, because development economists have studied poverty alleviation very intensively. And what they find is that we don't expect poverty alleviation to occur unless we have very substantial outside infusion of resources. And during the 1980s in China and rural areas, there's no outside infusion of resources, either from the Chinese state or from external agencies. That all comes later. And if anything, there's a withdrawal of resources as the erosion of collective institutions reduces education, availability of education, reduces availability of healthcare. So there are two possibilities. One is that the World Bank people don't know what they're talking about, and I'm willing to consider this. I don't know who's in the room here, but I'm willing to consider this. But I think it's pretty far-fetched. The World Bank is, they know a lot about development, and they've been studying these things very carefully for a long period of time, and they have a lot of field experience all over the world and so on. And the other possibility is something that's missing in the standard analysis of this circumstance by my colleagues. And my idea is that what's missing is the contribution of human resources. My idea is that the human capabilities, when we're talking about economic organization and economic development in the rural Chinese society, the level of capabilities is much higher than in other societies that are mired in similarly low incomes, as we see in China at the start of the reform period. And I should say, I don't want to go into detail, but the standard Chinese statistics overstate rural incomes at the start of reform. That's very easy to document. What's not so easy to figure out is what the actual level of rural incomes was. I figure it's about 25% below what the official figures show, which would put Chinese income at roughly a dollar a day, which is the level at which the World Bank diagnoses absolute poverty. So what's going on here? I think it's historical legacies at work, the legacy of literacy, of numeracy, that is people to be familiar with numbers and the pursuit of education, market knowledge, business experience. Tim Wright summarized all this by talking about China's abundance of small-time entrepreneurs. And we can see the effect of these capabilities Look at these data about township and village enterprises between 1978 and 1990. So in 1978, let's focus on industry, which is the biggest departure from the long history of rural life. So we're talking about 750,000 enterprises in 1978 and 7 million enterprises a decade later. So my question is, who was managing those 6.5 million enterprises that were created in a period of 10 years? Where did the accountants come from? And many of these enterprises developed into operations of substantial scale. By 1990, something like half of Chinese industrial exports came from the township and village enterprise sector. So the reality is that there were literally millions of people running around rural China at the start of reform who were capable of operating substantial industrial enterprises. And it's my belief that this is simply not the case in other low-income countries. I can go on about this, but I will spare you. These are short-term issues, but we can think in longer-term issues. We know that China's population had relatively high literacy and numeracy going back into the Qing period. Think about the success of overseas Chinese. I mean, I'm not talking in comparative terms. I'm trying to suggest to you that the economic capabilities among the Chinese population, and in particular the rural population, are unusually high for low-income societies. So overseas Chinese, I mean, we know about the success of overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia. Let me just mention several points that may not be familiar, that in Japan in the 1890s, foreigners were worried that if there's a war between China and Japan and the Japanese arrest all the Chinese businessmen in the Japanese treaty ports, who's going to run our businesses for us? And I love this material about Prato, Italy, today, where the Italian industrialists said the Chinese are very clever. They're not like other immigrants. That's the point I'm trying to make. There's a book now about this Prato, Italy town that the Chinese seem to have taken over. And the New York Times reporter talks about Chinese beating the Italians at their own game of tax evasion and navigating Italy's notoriously complex bureaucracy. That's the sort of thing I'm talking about. And here's another example. There is a literature focused on the former Soviet Union and the former Soviet satellites in Eastern Europe that argues that communism eroded social trust and therefore damaged entrepreneurial capabilities. And the evidence of this is unusually small rates of enterprise formation in these countries. And the metric is the number of enterprises, especially small enterprises, per 1,000 people. So I look at this and I say, all right, what about China? And these authors have some Chinese data, which are no good. So I've cooked up some Chinese data, which is what I do for a living. And the Chinese data, even if I omit a substantial category of rural enterprises, I omit rural agricultural businesses, the Chinese data are almost literally off the map. Only the data for Czech Republic exceed the figures that I compile for China, omitting rural agricultural businesses. So China, of course, some of these Eastern European countries have communism for several decades, the Russia and so on for a much longer period, but the communists are still there in China. If communism erodes social trust and undercuts entrepreneurship, it should do so in China as well. But here again, China is different. So what are the implications of this difference in human resource endowments? First of all, we were discussing this earlier outside. The idea of a Chinese model or a Beijing consensus goes out the window, because the underlying assumption is that pre-reform China is like other poor countries. So if we apply the policies that that supported the Chinese post-reform boom in other countries that will get similar results. But to make that connection, we have to assume that the initial conditions are similar, and I'm telling you that they're not similar, and therefore I don't believe that applying Chinese policies in Latin America or in Africa is necessarily going to produce anything like what we see in China. And the second implication is that multinational executives in a wide array of industries have consistently underestimated the catch-up capabilities of potential Chinese competitors. And I'm not an authority about this because I'm not involved intimately in particular businesses, but whenever I get an opportunity, I ask business executives if they agree with this opinion that I have, and the answer that I get is consistently yes. Most recently, I met someone in the executive in the electric power industry this past week, and this man said absolutely yes. So what I'm telling you is that Chinese society harbored human capabilities that were a major contributor to the economic dynamics we've seen in the past several decades. And the obvious question is, if Chinese society harbored all these capabilities, what took them so long? So the opposite question what I was taught to think about as a history student, why only in 1978? Why not at some earlier period? So let's think about that. So first of all, I'd say we can push back to 1949. I mean, we know that socialist systems stifle entrepreneurship. They snuff out incentives. You cannot have high-speed growth without entrepreneurship and without incentives. And then we get back to 1949. I would say we can push back to 1912 because we're not going to have accelerated growth with war, with civil war, with hyperinflation, without a national government, with civil unrest. But what about the decades before 1912? And particularly, what about the period from roughly 1870 to 1912? Here we have a system that's some sort of market economy, free trade, foreign investment, substantial inflow of both engineering technology and organizational technology, a government that doesn't have very much influence over the economy and is in certain instances moderately inclined to reform, and also the benefit of recovery from war. I mean, we know from the experience of Japan and Germany after the Second World War and from the experience of the US South after the Civil War that economies devastated by war often bounce back with remarkable speed, and China had such opportunities following the Taiping rebellion of the 1860s. So why not a big development spurt in the decades starting about 1870s? What are the constraints? What's holding them up? I've been involved with two colleagues, Lauren Brandt at the University of Toronto and Ma Dabin at London School of Economics, in writing a review essay on Chinese economic history. And we have finally finished our paper. It only took us 6 years. You may look for it in the Journal of Economic Literature. It is only 100 pages long. So what did we do? We tried to identify the foundations of the Chinese imperial political economy. And here's our list. And these foundations appear in the Song Dynasty. And we take them as given. And then we ask ourselves the question, just starting with these foundations and just thinking about what are the implications of these circumstances, the supreme authority of the emperor, a pre-modern transport system in a big country, the exam system selecting a pool of people to be appointed to official posts, the rural economy based on small-scale landowning, and public finances based on land tax. Let's just think about what kind of system is implied by these underlying conditions. And we discovered that we can come up with a very substantial proportion of the major features of the Ming-Qing economy, just starting from these circumstances. So we call this the equilibrium of the imperial political economy, and we use the word equilibrium because we think that once the economy develops these characteristics, it's very difficult to move off this combination of circumstances, and this is a system that responds to even substantial shocks like the Taiping uprising by bouncing back. It's a very stable system. So what are the characteristics? Small state, small body of officials, small revenues. I will show you some data about this momentarily. We have this vast space, so you have to decentralize, which means you have high agency costs, by which I mean the emperor is sending officials way over there to manage things, and it's very difficult to make sure the officials do what you want them to do. And a recent PhD from Northwestern University, Sun Tuan Hui, who's in the University of Singapore, has been focusing on this issue of agency costs for some time. Limited state capacity. They limit the things that they try to do. We have private property on the ground, even though in theory the emperor owns everything. We have the rule of man, official discretion, rather than the rule of law. We have strong local elites. We have a state that must defer to the interest of local elites. For example, the Qing Emperor Kangxi, one of the strongest emperors, decided that we must have a cadastral survey. We need to know who owns what land, and it never happened. And the reason it never happened was because the local elites did not want the state to know who owned what. They were happy, let them try and tax based on the Ming land registers, which were incomplete and out of date, and that's what happened. Even in this system, even one of the most powerful emperors, focusing on a fundamental issue underpinning the imperial system, could not get his orders implemented. So strong local elites, the state defers to their interests. The state must tolerate substantial malfeasance, for example, concealing land from the tax collectors, and corruption. And tiny elites capture a huge income share. So here's some data on government revenues. And notice the comparison between China and England, that in the late 18th century, China's government revenue was no larger than England's. And by the time of the Opium War, England's government revenue was more than four times China's. And look at this, per capita tax burden in grams of silver. I mean, these historians are doing wonderful comparative studies. By the first half of the 19th century, the per capita tax burden in England was literally 100 times the tax burden in China. Even the Ottoman Empire had per capita tax burden triple the Chinese. I mean, this is what I mean by a weak state with weak finances. Even as an undergraduate, I knew that the Qing didn't have a lot of revenue, but I had no idea about these comparisons. And here's what I mean by unequal income. This is Zhang Zhongli's study done in 1960, and where he says that gentry income, 2% of the population, had 24% of income. And if some of this sounds familiar to you, this is why historical study makes sense if we're interested in contemporary China. So what are the implications here? First, limited development of finance. As we do not have a clear legal system, so we can't have government debt instruments the way we do in England, the way we do in the Netherlands. And secondly, the historians come up with the term patronage in studying the economy. This starts with Prasenjit Dwara, and here's what he had to say on the subject. And David Foer has developed this and talks about the late Qing patronage economy. And there's a very nice book by a Japanese historian named Eiichi Motono, which really lays this out in detail. What Motono says is that any substantial business, and we're talking about the late 19th century now, or more generally Qing, requires accommodation with officials who have the power to strangle the business. The standard bargain is that officials protect businesses in return for informal revenue flows. And these links become very visible in the late 19th century when people try to innovate and they run into the sinews of these patronage networks. And here are several examples. Jardine Matheson, were Jardine Matheson able to get things done in Shanghai in the 1860s? I think so, except they couldn't do this. They couldn't establish a silk factory because they couldn't get raw materials. They worried about getting the machinery to China. They worried about training Chinese to run the machinery. They did all that, but the enterprise failed because, as the diaries of the head of Jardine said, suitable houses were refused me or set fire to, and what I actually built was pulled down, and the Chinamen that did assist me were put in chains. In other words, the officials protected the incumbent mercantile groups. Here's another example. I love this one. Tianjin in the 1920s, businessmen got sick of the monopoly of the transport guilds, so they bought trucks. And that didn't work. The guilds threatened to kill the general manager of the factory that had purchased trucks, so they had to relent and let the guilds run things as they had for centuries. And here, Jose Abelu Morse, the historian of the treaty ports, talking about the Chinese guild system that must by its nature hinder freedom of enterprise and independence of individual initiative. This is what he wrote in 1909. And Shannon Brown writing a couple of generations later, the Chinese merchant was hardly in a position to play the role of Schumpeterian entrepreneur under this system. So what are the constraints? Why don't we see development in the late 19th century? And I should say that we've wrestled with this for 5 years before we finally got points on the board. But here is my list. First of all, in the late 19th century, the leaders in China had no vision of development. They had no understanding of the opportunities following in the wake of the Industrial Revolution. Even the reformers, people like Zhang Zhidong, celebrated the idea of a small state, of essentially a sort of stationary state where we replicate the economic activities of the past. Then there was this lack of revenue. In low-income countries don't develop without substantial state intervention, which requires revenue. In the mid-19th century, the Japanese government spent 5% of GDP on economic reforms and experimentation and investment, but the Chinese government never got 5% of GDP. So the Japanese were spending a larger proportion of their national income on new economic investments than the Chinese government had to spend on everything. And next, this surprised me, lack of administrative structure. The Qing government simply was not in a position to formulate and implement economic policy. And the historians are very clear about this. So this Mayers, who was a treaty port observer writing in the late 1890s, talked about the central government registering and checking the actions of provincial administrations rather than assuming a direct initiative. And Guan Manbun's study of the salt industry, the same thing. The Board of Revenue was primarily a transmission center for documents and repository for ledgers. And Julius Strauss calls the Qing a presiding state that was content to reign and loosely regulate rather than rule. And then this patronage economy, which is a formidable obstacle to innovation, along with narrow elite domination, and finally international isolation. So I want to think about the 20th century in China as a process of gradually eroding these barriers and also eroding new barriers that the People's Republic of China creates. So the ideology issue fades rapidly in the 20th century. So by the time of the Nanjing government in the 1920s, they had a very clear idea. They wanted development. They understood the potential benefits. The revenue problem was not solved until after 1949. And then it was solved very quickly. So as early as 1952, government revenue was more than 10% of total output. Administrative structure, there is progress both before and after 1927. But again, this issue is resolved finally only after 1949, where for the first time in Chinese history, you have a government that can penetrate down to the village level. And unfortunately, for several decades, they penetrate to the village level with economic policies that are counterproductive. But nevertheless, the capacity is there, certainly by the end of the 1950s. The issue of isolation, there's very rapid progress after the Sino-Japanese War. The Treaty of Shimonoseki, what the Chinese call the Maguan Treaty, a huge shock on Chinese public opinion, which rapidly came to recognize the importance of learning about international developments. Of course, there's retrogression under the People's Republic. I myself was shocked when I first visited China in 1975 to meet members of the national elite who spoke fluent English, who had participated in Chinese embassies in Europe, whose ignorance of the basic facts of political life in the United States was just flabbergasting. And the difference between what people on the street knew about the United States 15 years later and what these elites knew was just astonishing to me. Then there was an issue of incentives, which was not a problem under the Qing, but became a problem under the People's Republic and was swept away gradually after the reform started. And finally, this issue of patronage economy, which was somewhat alleviated under the Kuomintang, and then essentially disappeared in the socialist phase in the People's Republic because they eliminated private business, and then, as we know, has come back with a vengeance during the reform era. So we can think about comparing the Qing system and the current system under the People's Republic, many continuities. In both cases, we see an authoritarian system with very few checks and balances. The leaders decide what to do, and they do it. In both cases, we see merit-based entry into elites that have both political and economic power. In both cases, we see high agency costs. What goes on at the local level today is often quite different from what the people in Beijing desire to have going on at the local level. Take local government debt as an example. It's not allowed, but now we're told about how many trillion renminbi of debt exists. In both cases, we have economic decentralization. In both cases, we see the importance of local policy experimentation. In both cases, we see vertical alignment of incentives spanning both the elite and the citizenry. That is, now everybody wants economic growth. Everybody has benefited enormously from growth. In both cases, we see this patronage economy, which is very much visible today. Commenting on the Bo Xilai ouster last year, there was an article in the Financial Times. It was on a Saturday. And I read it, and I thought, I must save this. And I didn't, and I can't find it. If any of you has this on hand, let me know. And it said that the business community in Chongqing is complaining because they already paid their dues to the Bo Xilai administration at the time of Chunjie. And now there's this new administration. Now we have to pay again. And of course, what wasn't known at the time was there was going to be a third administration before the year was over. So these people had to pay three times. And finally, in both cases, we have high levels of income inequality. And I don't need to recite data about income inequality in China today for this audience. But there are also very dramatic differences between what we see in Qing and what we see in China today. One has to do with economic objectives. Stability then, and as Cheng Gangshu says, that after the reforms, economic growth becomes a life and death issue for China. And I think he's exactly right. I mean, look how rapidly and how effectively the Chinese government responded to the economic crash of 2008, where they got a V-shaped recovery. We talked about it, but we're still waiting. The current regime has vastly expanded the paths to entry into the elite, whereas the Mao Zedong regime actually narrowed the paths, even made them even narrower than they were under the Qing. And as opposed to the weak Qing state, we now have a powerful state apparatus with leverage over huge amounts of resources. And finally, we have a regime that embraces globalization. And China's shift from isolation to engagement with the global economy is really quite astonishing. When I first visited China in 1975, we spent a month visiting factories. We probably visited 55 factories in 30 days. And aside from cultural products, I bought a PLA hat to give to a neighbor of mine as a joke. But aside from cultural products and the most basic industrial goods, like plain white cotton fabric, we saw nothing that could be sold in rich country markets. And now China is the number one global trading nation. So finally, what next? I wrote a paper with Dwight Perkins in 2005 in which we projected that China's economy could grow in real terms, that is adjusted for inflation, between 6% and 8% per year for two decades. I don't see anything that's happened that would cause me to change that prognosis. I recently got an email from Dwight. He wanted to say 6% to 9%. Economists make a big deal about small changes in growth rates. And he wrote and said, in retrospect, I think 6% to 8% was enough. But I thought 9% was too much in 2005. And we had a polite difference of opinion about this at the time. I think that looks plausible today. And what that means is that going forward in the next 10 years, we're looking at lower growth rates than what the Chinese have reported over the past decade. I think that looking ahead, human capital, which I've already talked about, is a major asset for China. And I think we can see multiple areas where what's going on today is going to enlarge the supply of human capital going forward. First of all, huge expansion of tertiary education. China now has more college and university students than the United States, and that gap is going to increase dramatically going forward. I think they're going to expand both the quantity and the quality of their graduates. I mean, taking economics as an example, in the 1980s, looking for candidates to admit to our PhD program, I didn't want economists because I figured that the value added in economics education in China at the time was negative. And better have scientists that knew math and hadn't been taught nonsense about economics. That's no longer true. I mean, the university level economics education in China is rapidly improving. The quality of economic advice that's available to Chinese governments at all levels has improved steeply in the last 25 years, and I think this is just an illustration of the upgrading of human capital that we see across the board in China. And globalization will be hugely beneficial. I mean, China's overseas direct investment now is quite substantial. It's growing very fast. Within several years, there'll be more outbound international investment than incoming in China. Now, some of this investment is directed toward resource acquisitions. but a substantial proportion of it is aimed at manufacturing, where the objective is to learn about international markets and to learn about production and management. So for example, we visit a joint venture machine tool operation in Beijing, and the Chinese participants say, what we're doing here is we're working with these Japanese who know how to produce top quality machine tools. This Chinese fellow said, our industrial culture doesn't allow us to do this, so we have to learn from them. What you see here is one way of upgrading our capabilities. He said the other way of doing it, which some other machine tool firms have done, is to go out and buy a German, an Italian, a Japanese machine tool company and learn from them that way. So for example, Ikigai, which is Japan's oldest machine tool company, which I visited as a graduate student in 1969, is now owned by a Chinese firm. And finally, the development of Chinese private business is very, very impressive. They're operating in a very difficult environment. Now they have legal protection on paper. The Constitution and the property law says the government will protect the legal rights of private owners, but it's not operational. What department of the Chinese government is in charge of protecting the legal rights of private business owners? What phone number do they call if somebody is trampling their legal rights? But despite these difficulties, I mean, the share of private business in China's economy is large, and it's growing. Every year. So this is a system in which we have interlocking political and economic elites, which is an element of continuity, coupled with massive state control over resources, which is something new. This could accelerate or it could obstruct economic progress. I mean, that this system has the capacity to concentrate massive resources on high priority programs, so space exploration, building large scale passenger aircrafts, nuclear electric power development, biotechnology, and so on. Obvious potential to accelerate growth, but first of all, will they select the right areas? I mean, there's an endless debate in the economics profession going back to the early 19th century about whether industrial policies can accelerate development. The debate swings back and forth, and my impression is that right now, not talking about China, but in the economics profession generally, the debate is tilting in favor of activist policies. For example, people say that the US government has intervened very constructively to promote the development of biotechnology in our economy. So there is potential here. But there are also questions. So if we think about the Chinese experience in state management of investment, the results are not good. Look at this. Here, the quarterly changes in the investment component of national expenditure, which is the most volatile. So during the recent crash and global recession, this is the worst downturn in living memory since the 1930s. The quarterly change in fixed capital formation never hit minus 10%. Either in the US, in the UK, or in the EC. But if you name any four consecutive quarters in Chinese recent economic history, I will show you a quarter in which fixed investment dropped by at least 45%. And the figures for the first quarter of this year are just out, and they show that fixed investment in the first quarter of this year was 49% of fixed investment in the final quarter of last year. This cannot happen in a market economy. This is a footprint of leftovers from the Soviet planning system. This arrangement leads to poor investment returns. It leads to enormous seasonal fluctuations. There they are. It leads to elevated financial risk, and it leads to slow growth of employment. And the question is, now we have the state intervening in R&D activity on a similarly grand scale. And are we going to get similarly unpleasant results? I don't know. We'll see. Also, China has a lot of unconventional institutional structures. And we see examples in recent economic history in which unconventional institutional structures can support remarkable growth. I'm thinking particularly of Japan, during the first few post-World War II decades. But also in Japan, we see a circumstance in which institutions that contributed to growth for several decades turn into obstacles. And that is one of the reasons for Japan's weak economic performance over the last two decades. Can this happen in China? I'm not sure, but I'm planning to go back and review work on the Japanese economy because I riff through books and I think China, 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 and I'm not sure if this is superficial or if it's serious. Another issue to think about, will the current Chinese system divert talent from productive activity into pursuit of rents and graft? I think this is a possible danger. And finally, will China's new leaders either attempt major reform, I don't know, or if they do attempt major reform, will they have the energy, determination, and muscle to push it through? I don't know. These are all questions to think about. I can't answer any of these questions at this point, but I'd like to leave you with two thoughts. One is that as we think about these things, we should pay attention to human capital, which in China is unusually rich and unusually deep, and will get richer and deeper going forward. And secondly, if we want to understand what's going on in China, I think that careful thinking about historical circumstances is very helpful, and that it's easy to get lost in its absence. That's what I have to say to you this evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening to this, and I'm told that we will
got time for questions.
Encourage questions, which I will be delighted to answer until I'm dragged away by by our host.
So we do have some time for questions. We would like you to, we have a microphone that we need you to speak into. Please identify yourself and then short questions.
And please speak up because I'm hard of hearing. Sir.
So I'll let him after me.
Yeah. I'm Michael Yehuda, based here at the Siegel Center. If I understood the thrust of your presentation, it was that Chinese entrepreneurial capacity is somehow or other a product of its history. Yet your description of the Ming and Qing system seemed an obstacle to that. Mm-hmm. So are you suggesting, therefore, that somehow or other it's innate in some way? Because you're speaking of a period of several hundred years in which it was discouraged. So how did it survive that long period?
Right. Perhaps I'm not making myself clear. I do think that that entrepreneurial capacity is built into the system. I think that it was there historically. I think that this patronage issue probably stifled entrepreneurship before 1850. We know what was going on after 1850 because when outsiders come in, they run into the system and then things go wrong. We don't have evidence of the operation of this system before 1850. My guess is that it was there. But there's not so much footprints in the historical sand because all the people who were on the ground understood the rules. And so they didn't walk into the buzzsaw the way Jardine Matheson did because they knew what was going on. I think the evidence of these entrepreneurial capabilities in the earlier period comes from sources like William Skinner's work on Chinese in Thailand, and he has very graphic quotations. What happens when the Chinese go to Thailand, where people are accustomed to a land in which it's easy to make a living because of the climate and so on, and then these Chinese, who Skinner describes as coming as being fresh off the land. I mean, these are not highly educated urbanites; they are nungmin. Who go to Thailand, and he said they come from a grimly Malthusian world, that's his phrase, in which they have to work day and night to survive. And you put them in there with these ties, and soon the Chinese come to dominate the economy. The foreign trade in Thailand is a royal monopoly. The Chinese build the ships, they provide the crews, They do the commerce. Why do they do the commerce? It's because the Chinese, first of all, they have Chinese acquaintances in ports all over Asia, and secondly, they're familiar with the nuances of corruption and wheeling and dealing, other things you have to know to succeed in foreign trade. And this is, I should emphasize, this is not a nationwide circumstance, it's regional. Several years ago in Xi'an, we visited a cotton textile plant, and they were just producing white cotton cloth, selling it overseas through an agent who took most of their profits. And we asked the manager, have you ever thought of, say, dyeing the fabric? And the manager said, no, that's too risky. So you go, you get a contract, you give samples, and they make an order, and then you dye all this fabric, and then they say, no, it's the wrong color. We said, we can't do that. And we said, but we were just in Hangzhou, and we met people who were doing exactly that, and they've been doing it for a long time. And he said, Nanfang Ren, those southerners. He said, they do that stuff. But we do. So here's this man implicitly making a distinction between Nanfang Ren, who do this entrepreneurial stuff in Zhejiang and places like that, and we Chinese, who don't. We make white cloth. We don't dye it. And this stuff pops up all over the place. Several years ago, the Chinese Minister of Commerce went to Wuhan, and he gave a public talk in which he said, we need to send people from here to coastal China to train business brains. He said that in front of a Wuhan audience. Essentially what he said, you people are a bunch of bumpkins, you don't know anything, and we'll send you to Guangzhou or Shanghai or somewhere where you can learn something, and then you can come back here and turn this economy around. So it is a circumstance that has to do with the depth of people's involvement with markets and with international commerce and migration back and forth. I mean, it's no accident that you go to places like Zhongshan in Guangdong, and in this tiny, nondescript place, they have a museum. For example, all the big department stores in China were all started by people from this one tiny place. That they learned about the stuff. Some of them had been to Australia, and so on. So that, I mean, I think this phenomenon is very real. Sir,
I have a question about the forecast of 6 to 8% growth for the next 20 years. What I'm wondering is whether it's predicated on the idea of major reforms, and my idea is that Chinese GDP growth from, I forget when, from whenever the record started until 1978, it was 6 plus 6 point something.
That's percent. Too high, but
I don't know if you believe that or not.
No.
That's another question. But if we believe that, it seems like somebody could say, you know what, they could have an even worse government than they have now, and even worse economic system, and still have 6 to 8%.
Okay.
In
the pre-reform circumstance, if you take out price distortions, the growth rate's about 4, not 6. And so our forecast was written in 2005, covering 20 years, so to 2025, and we assumed domestic political stability, and we assumed no breakdown of international markets. That was we were not we had no specific forecast about the presence or absence of major reform. What we were looking at was the growth of labor supply, the growth of human capital, the likely growth of physical capital, and then what the implication of. So we start with the resource growth, then we say what if there's 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%, 9% growth, and then calculate the implied growth of productivity, and then think about whether this makes sense. And what we felt was that there had to be some slowdown in productivity growth, because some of the big contributors to productivity growth, the shift from plan to market, the shift from closed economy to open economy, the shift from crazy prices to sensible prices, those gains are largely behind us, or were largely behind us by 2005. So what we're really doing is making judgments about the plausibility of various rates of productivity growth over a 20-year period, and we weren't talking about reform. Sir.
Stanley Covert. I was a student in the Soviet Union during the 1970s, and then the talk was of moving from extensive development to intensive development. So you're nodding, you know what I'm talking about. They couldn't do it. I've heard in China the same thing. Do you think they can do it?
They have done it.
They have done it.
Absolutely.
Could you elaborate on that?
Productivity growth rates in industry during the past 10 or 15 years are very, very impressive. The most recent study that I'm aware of, and these are people who are very, very careful with data, are by Lauren Brandt and some other people, and it was in the Journal of Development Economics within the past 2 years. There's no question that we're looking at an economy that is delivering intensive growth. On the back, sir. And then next.
My name is Deep. I'm a student here at the Elliott School, and my question was about innovation in China. Going forward, how do you see them tackling that issue?
Interesting question. I'm involved in a substantial research project to study the interaction between public policy and innovation in Chinese manufacturing. We're starting by trying to learn about electricity and telecoms. I have no answer, but what we see, everybody is talking about this issue at an elevated macro level. They all cite the same figures, the number of patents, the number of engineering graduates, and so on. And very few people are talking about what's going on the ground. So what we're doing is going and talking to people in these industries, trying to find out how government is attempting to influence innovation and to answer the question whether all these government programs have any effect. And it's not clear. I mean, some of the industries that have progressed the fastest are industries that are completely off the radar of industrial policy, like construction machinery. So I'm quite agnostic on this point, but it is a very big, important, and I think completely open question. And if you are looking for dissertation topics, there are a lot of industries to look at. Was there a? Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
My name is Jun Hua Wu. I have two questions. I think around 10 years ago, you published an article about the reliability of China's
yes.
statistics data. So what do you think the yeah. current...
Okay, what's the second question?
A second question is, you shared with your study on the similarity and difference between Qing and the current. Mm-hmm. And did you have get some implication from the past to when we think about China's future?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So as was mentioned, I wrote a paper in 2001 that essentially said the Chinese government was intentionally publishing false GDP data. I didn't use that language, but everybody in China understood exactly what I intended to say. Here's what I think. There's a wonderful book called Animal Spirits by George Akerlof, the Nobel laureate and a co-author. And he talks about, they talk about the link between public psychology and economic activity. And they say the link between public psychology and economic activity is especially strong in the downward phase of the business cycle. And my thought is that the Chinese leadership figured this out before Akerlof and Schiller wrote this book. And China is in the position where the government announcement is treated as the literal truth, not only by the domestic press, but by the international press, by the financial community. There are very few people who dare to say that the Chinese government is inventing statistics. And so they have the capacity, which most governments don't have. I mean, wouldn't it have been nice if President Obama had said during the election campaign, guess what, unemployment is now at 4.8%. How many votes would that have won? But can't do that in the United States because the economics profession would rise up on its hind legs and so on, and the newspapers would howl bloody murder, but this doesn't happen in China. The dogs don't bark when the Chinese government does this. So I think that most of the time, most of the statistics represent the efforts of the people in the Tongjiju, the National Bureau of Statistics, who are not political hacks. They are serious technocrats, in my considerable experience, I should say. What they're trying to do is trying to measure what's going on. It's a difficult job. The economy is changing rapidly. They're understaffed and so on. And the local governments often publish false statistics. Everybody knows that. But I think from time to time, the national government steps in and overrides what the technocrats say. I think this happened in 2008 and 2009, as I think it happened in 1999 and then in 2000. And your second question, let me say this. There's a lot of talk about corruption and this sort of thing in China today. I think that if we look at the similarities between the patronage economy of 1880 and the patronage economy of today, we have to question the people who say this can't go on. I mean, look at what China has accomplished in the face of large-scale corruption and this patronage system, and all the stuff that we're learning about the Bo Xilai family and the Wang Jiabao family, and all. I mean, no wonder they're arresting people who are campaigning for anti-corruption policies. Who is to say that this is not sustainable? I don't know. I think it's dangerous, but they could go forward with this.
Sir, one more question.
Go ahead. This is the one I want.
Anything? I'm Marco Nicapa. I'm a former diplomat. I'm now currently with the National Nuclear Security Administration, and I'm not an economist. is there anything to be learned in the due of economic growth and development during the Japanese occupation of Manchuria? In a sense, whether did they change some of the strictures? Was there? I think you studied this problem, and did that make a difference in actually removing some of the obstacles to economic growth?
Probably yes. Japan implemented essentially a planned economy in Northeast China and Manchukuo. I mean, they published long-term plans. I have seen Japanese documents published during the 1930s that included planned coal output in 1955. I mean, they were really thinking long-term. And I think just as the upper echelons of this system were very important in the post-World War II development of Japan. I mean, Chalmers Johnson has written that the deputy minister of the MITI, the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, that Susan Sho, for decades in the post-war period, were all people who had worked in the planning system of Manchuria in the 1930s. Many of the lower level people participated in the early plan system in China. For example, I met a Japanese woman the other night. I met her because she had translated a book written by a friend of mine. And it turned out that this woman, who is now probably in her 70s, was born in Dalian or in Jilin. And her father was a railway engineer on the Mantetsu. And after 1945, they stayed in China for several years. Her father was employed by the successor to the Japanese railway system, and there were a lot of people, a lot of such activity. So, of course, against that, you have to recall that the Soviets looted Manchurian industry at the end of the war, and there's this book, The Pauli Report, where there are these pictures. What the Soviets would do is they'd build a rail line up to the side of these factories, they knocked a hole in the factory wall, and then extended the rail line into the factories, loaded the machinery onto flat cars, and took it to Siberia where it was dumped and rusted. But still, some of the human infrastructure of the Manchukuo industrial machine certainly contributed. And I think there have been, I think possibly William Kirby Somebody has written about this recently, and I haven't kept up with this. But of course, at the same time, some of the problems that you see in that part of China are attributable to the same phenomenon. You've got these parts of Dongbei that I mean, most of China has been part of a planned economy from the 1950s till the 1980s. But these places in Dongbei, like Anshan Steel, have been part of a planned economy going back to 1915. So it's like it's like Russia, that there are just generations of people that have no experience of marketing, of selecting a product mix, dealing with customers, and anything like that. I visited Anshan Steel with a Chinese friend sometime in the mid 1990s, and my friend from Beijing was just horrified at what we encountered there. I mean, we asked them what their market plan was, and they said that they were going to dominate the market for steel in northwest China. And I wondered then, what are they going to do? They're going to produce collars for sheep or something like that. And also, whatever it was going to be, what was going to stop the people in Taiyuan and Wuhan and Chongqing, who are a lot closer, from producing the sheep collars or whatever they thought the market was. I mean, it was. They had the faintest idea about marketing or business. And as we left, my Chinese friend said, these people are not businessmen, they are officials, he said contemptuously. And he was exactly right. I mean, I asked him what their market share was in Guangdong, of the steel market in Guangdong, and they never answered. It was pretty clear after 5 or 10 minutes. What they were telling me was a big round number, approximately zero. And I asked them, what's the problem? And they said, well, in Guangdong, he said, they have these Shangzhen Qie, and they know what people want, and we can't do it. So the pre-1945 industrialization in China's northeastern region cuts two ways. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry that we don't have more time. This is very interesting, and I look forward to the article you just mentioned. That's going to solve a lot of problems for my own class on modern China. I'm waiting for that very anxiously. I think it was a very enlightened and enlivening lecture tonight. I want to thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Fall off. I really can't wait for that article. That's going to solve somebody's problems.